Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grania Reed, Head of Marketing at ExchangeWire, and today I am joined by Ant Hoppert, founder of the 99ers. Ant, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Great to have you here.
Yeah, pleased to be here.
Along with Ant today, we've got Rachel Smith, CEO of ExchangeWire. Rachel, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Chi.
Great. This week, we're going to be discussing three news stories: Google's rollout of search profiles for publishers and creators in the US, as well as the UK ban on social media for under 16s, and alongside that, Accenture's acquisition of Whaler. So to kick off the first story, Google is rolling out search profiles for publishers and creators in the US, giving them dedicated landing pages within Google Discover, where users can follow their content and view articles, videos, and social media posts in one place. The new profiles create a centralized hub intended to strengthen audience engagement and visibility within Google's ecosystem. Initially available to publishers and creators with substantial followings on platforms such as YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, and X, search profiles can be customized with bios, avatars, website links, and social accounts. Google said the feature may also generate or enhance existing knowledge panels, helping publishers build a more consistent presence across search. So, Ant, I'm going to come to you first on this. With this new feature, what do you see with the decline of publisher traffic, which would cause by AI overviews?
Yeah. Well, obviously, this is a big issue for the publishers in particular, I think. I mean, we'll talk about the fact that they've launched it for publishers and creators, and I think that's also interesting. But certainly, I would imagine the biggest problem is for the publishers who've seen a massive decline in their search traffic as a result of the AI overviews, and have been, you know, for a number of years kind of optimizing for search. So obviously that's been a big issue for them. It's some sort of mitigation, I think, on Google's part. But really, you know, Google are still controlling the whole ecosystem here, aren't they? So I think it's a little gift on one hand, while they've obviously been taken away on the other. For me, I think this is another sign that the publishers need to own their audience, you know, build their own direct relationships with consumers and really be the trusted voice that people want to go to directly, because it may help a bit, but ultimately at the moment it's all still owned by Google, and I think that's a massive risk if you're a publisher.
Rachel, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think it's similar, or do you feel like it's just strengthening Google's stronghold?
Yeah, so the thing is, I suppose when I first read it, I just thought, very similarly to what you've just characterised, Ant, that it's another Google manoeuvre where they give with one hand and take with the other. You know, I don't feel that it will really make a hugely meaningful difference to the main issue that publishers are grappling with, as you say, drop in search referral traffic. But I think what I thought was interesting about it is it is, stepping aside for a minute from, you know, the sort of impact that Google's decisions have on publishers' businesses, which is obviously a big issue and definitely means that they should be doing what you described, which is thinking about how they own the relationship with their audience. But stepping aside from that, I thought it's another indication that we're now operating in a world where, which I've been saying for a while, we talked about this, I think, even when we started having, when we had conversations around predictions last year, you know, what's 2026 going to mean for various parts of the advertising and marketing ecosystem. One of the things I said then, and I strongly believe it now, is that publishers need to now think of themselves as brands. You know, if you're talking about premium publishers who've always had a strong brand, they also then need to be operating in an advertising and marketing ecosystem as though they are brands. So they need to be, and they need to have that in their mind when they're doing what you suggested, which is strengthening that relationship with their audience. And this made me think, well, the way that it's being sort of, you know, billed by Google is as an opportunity for publishers to, you know, do a number of things that would appear in their AI search profiles, which is akin to thinking about how they're marketing and promoting themselves as a brand. So if I was a publisher, if I didn't need another reason to do this, and I've got plenty, I would be thinking I need to actually be using any opportunity for visibility anywhere. So if it is in yep. Google AI search overview, to market myself as a brand and to do that via as many different mediums and channels as I possibly could. So if I was a publisher, I wouldn't be thinking, oh, great, this solves my problems, because it doesn't. And I would be thinking, here we go again, Google. And I'd be busy doing all these other things that I should be doing and I probably have been doing anyway if I'm a premium publisher. We know loads of the premium publishers in the UK have been fiercely protecting their data and improving their direct relationships with their audiences. But I'd be looking at this thinking, okay, well, what am I going to use this search overview, you know, availability for, like, you know, sort of format for? What else could I do with it that might really grab consumers' attention? And so I'd also be really interested in what the format actually looks like. Yep. You know, can I show video in that format? Can I, you know, and then that also got me thinking, is this Google's, you know, attempt at trying to build out another search advertising opportunity, right? Yeah, so yeah, let's make AI search overviews more comprehensive. Will it include an ad unit? Will they try to use that to, you know, make some advertising revenue off that, you know, display of results? Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess we'll see. But I guess from the creator side too, how do you see creators with huge followings on the likes of YouTube, Instagram, TikTok and X, like we discussed earlier? How do you think these profiles, how will they use these profiles, I guess, to consolidate their presence?
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me like it's probably more of an opportunity for those guys where most of their traffic, well, most of their kind of search traffic would have come from within the social platforms rather than within Google. And this, you know, this does now give them another touch point, another channel where they can, you know, they can find new audiences or, you know, consolidate all their different platforms together. I understand it's going to pull in content from all the different channels. So that, yeah, I think it's probably another opportunity for them to create their profile. Obviously, they don't own it here. And I think for creators as well, they should, you know, also start to think of themselves as brands and businesses going forward. And, you know, how do they ensure they maintain the ownership of their audiences? I mean, I think they're in a pretty good place at the moment in owning owning audiences, having those trusted voices. So, yeah, how do they maintain that? What is this this new search profile as part of their kind of wider ecosystem? But yeah, it feels like it's maybe more of an opportunity for them than it is for the publishers. But I found it interesting that Google have launched this as a service for both at the same time, almost kind of putting them together on a level playing field, yeah. Which I don't know, again, if that's, you know, done as part of a play for Google. But, yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and that's precisely the thing that makes me think, well, if I was a publisher, I'd be thinking, how can I use this as a channel in the way that a content creator would? And yeah. So I think what we're arriving at is a sort of position where if we think about people's consumption habits, it's not going to matter to people that are consuming the content whether it's coming from a you know, well-known publisher. But I mean, it might in some instances, but in a general sense, it's probably not going to matter where it's coming from. It's going to be more about how they're actually consuming it. So, yeah. You know, publishers need to be thinking of themselves as brands for sure, but also as content creators.
Yeah.
And content creators, like you said, can be using this as another touch point and be thinking, well, what kind of content could I be displaying in this environment yeah. that might attract more people to my social media profiles?
Exactly. Yeah, no, really interesting. And I guess the takeaway is try and see yourself as a brand or as a content creator. Yeah.
And don't trust Google. Sorry, big G.
Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to the second story. The UK has officially banned social media for children under 16 in a move intended to give kids their childhood back. The government plans to use the same model as Australia, which would capture user-to-user platforms such as Snapchat, TikTok, YouTube and Instagram. The UK will also be the first to implement blocks on functions such as live streaming and stranger communication with children. These restrictions will apply to a range of online services beyond social media, including gaming sites and AI romantic companion chatbots. Ofcom will conduct a rapid study on effective age assurance measures for verifying whether someone is over 16, making it harder for children to bypass these safeguards. So, Ant, what do you take of this news? And do you think, what do you think this will look like in practice?
Well, first of all, I'm really interested in it from two points of view, professionally and personally, because I have three children who are all kind of pretty much teenagers. So
under 16?
I've got a 17-year-old, a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Oh, wow. You're going to get a range of views there.
So, yeah. And I've obviously seen the massive impact that social media has had on all of us, but in particular on the children and their phone habits. And I think action has to be taken. I mean, luckily, we're not at the point where we've had any of the, you know, really dreadful harm. And, you know, there's some terrible stories that have been resurfaced in the press again this week. But the impact's clear to see, and I think action had to be taken. Will this solve it? No, not certainly not in the short term. And I think everyone would be naive to think that kids are not going to find workarounds. You know, I've spoken this week against some friends in Australia and know that, you know, the children there are all finding kind of workarounds for the age verification process. So that will happen, of course. But I think this isn't a short-term play. The question is, you know, can we continue to allow our children to access these environments without any kind of barriers in place? And I don't think we can. So I think we've got to start somewhere. We've got to make it harder, just as we do with other addictive products and experiences like gaming and alcohol and smoking, and I would kind of put it in that kind of bracket. So we've got to make it harder. We've got to start making steps. Unfortunately, I think for my children's generation, I think we're probably beyond saving.
Yeah,
I think what we're talking about here is the first steps to saving the next generation. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't really, that's crossed my mind, but I haven't thought about it through that specific lens, that actually the biggest impact of this, if it is the sort of legislative control that we can imagine is going to have the same widespread impact that things like, you know, banning smoking has had, it's really going to have its most beneficial impact on the generation of children that are just being born now. And that's kind of quite exciting for them. Mm-hmm. But I completely agree with Anne on this, insofar as it is absolutely like banning tobacco and putting restrictions and age controls around gambling and alcohol consumption. I think that it has been absolutely problematic in Australia because it's a complex thing to achieve. You know, it's also not the banning of one individual thing, which is what smoking was. That was a lot easier. It was more arbitrary, arguably. It's the banning of something that's quite complex and quite far-reaching. And what we heard in Australia in the early days especially was lots of children or, you know, young people who were on the cusp of the age restriction especially saying, well, it's, you know, one of the main ways that I interact with my friends and, or, you know, I'm part of a sports club and that's how we share all of the news and information about what we're up to, and that's how I keep, you know, that's how I keep up to date with what's happening elsewhere within the sporting competition that our club is part of. And there's practical things that it offers that you wouldn't want people to be restricted or, you know, to be excluded from. But there's a part of me that thinks, couldn't we achieve most of those things in another way? Number one, I would say that because I'm old. I'm not suggesting we go fully back to an analog way of sharing that information, but there are other ways we could share that information. And then from my experience of chatting with young Australians and kids, and then parents of younger kids, because all of my nephews and all of my friends' kids are much older now, so they're not subjected to it. But is that most kids were saying really what they used a lot of platforms for was for direct messaging, and so now they're just doing that elsewhere. You know, they're back to using messaging services rather than the content sharing side of things. So I think that says a lot about, I mentioned all of those things to say, that says a lot about consumption habits and what we do when things are taken away from us, because I'm also that old that I can still remember when the smoking ban came into force in Australia. I was a university student because it came into force a lot earlier on. It came in the 90s compared with when it was implemented throughout Europe, and people were aghast. They were like, there's no way that you can control how, like, okay, in a restaurant perhaps, but you can't control where people are smoking. It's never going to work, and it won't make a jot of difference to people's, you know, ability or desire to smoke cigarettes. And you look at the statistics and they were totally wrong. It made a massive difference. The other argument was always, well, won't it fire up this kind of black market? And weirdly, it took a long time, but it has actually given rise to a little bit of a black market. That's more of a recent thing, though, and probably somewhat connected to vaping as well.
Yeah, and probably tax
and the costs and that's all a good point too. But then, interesting that you mentioned tax, because I think the real restriction here is who is implementing the guardrails and the controls and who is paying for the consequences of that. And one of the reasons why it's still not necessarily achieving what we would want it to achieve, it's very early days, it needs to be tested, but it's because the big tech companies that own and run social media platforms do not give a shit about it. In fact, they don't want it. They want to do everything they possibly can to make it, you know, to be obstructive. And actually, I think the next step that we're going to need to take as a society, and probably from a legislative point of view, is we're requiring them to take it more seriously. Yes. So the age restriction technology that's available could work a lot better than it's currently working, but the controls are in the hands of the social media platform, so they can decide which level of controls they apply and which they don't. So yes, technology tools could get a bit more sophisticated, and they absolutely will, but you know, big tech companies that own social media platforms need to be required to do something about this.
Yep.
So both on the control element and on the what kind of an experience are you creating for people?
Exactly.
One of the main drivers behind this is, of course, the health and well-being of children and young people, and our responsibility as adults to protect them. But it's also that as adults, we all completely recognise how addictive these platforms are and what a time suck they are on your life and how at least probably certainly 50%, if not 60 to 70% of what you're consuming on social media platforms is completely unimportant, you know, doesn't add any value to your life. So we've got to kind of grapple with all of that.
That's the opportunity, I think. You know, I think, as I said, it is important to take that first step to get us on the journey to improving this. I hope that it will be somewhat of a wake-up call to the tech platforms that, okay, this is you know, something that's we can't avoid any longer. It looks like there's another, you know, whole load of countries about to follow suit as well. So hopefully that, you know, that kind of groundswell will have an impact. And the opportunity is to create, you know, better places, better experiences. They've, you know, obviously everything's optimized at the moment to engagement, and that's led to this horrible addictive experience, which is hard enough to manage as an adult, let alone as a child. And the opportunity is to create a better experience, something that is actually worth our time and safer, and, you know, for children to be in. There is so much great stuff that social media can do. It can create communities. It can be a place for creativity and learning and all that great stuff. So if I was a tech company, I'd be focused on creating those kind of experiences rather than, you know, trying to hold on to something that I think will be part of the past.
Yeah. And count yourselves lucky that you're not a tobacco company. Actually, you're not selling just a single product. Actually, you've got the vastness of this incredible platform. So focus on all the good things that you can do with it. And that's where I think the marketing and advertising experience comes in, specifically advertising. If we think about how the advertising industry is at least trying to move towards better quality advertising, more relevant, less intrusive, if we've got, you know, if those social media platforms aren't just monetizing themselves through volume of advertising, but rather being locked into trying to support the quality of advertising and the environment that it supports, then we start to change the equation across the piece. Yep. And we could all be doing something on that.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, there's so many people that are following similar processes, obviously Australia being the first last December. Malaysia are also introducing restrictions this month where social media platforms with at least 8 million users must implement an age verification system. Similar UAE, they've introduced a child digital safety law, which isn't exactly a social media ban. And it applies to all of the digital platforms, but it'll be fully compliant or expected to be by January of next year.
Mm. Well, you've reminded me. That's reminded me, G. I was listening to one of the Prof G podcasts last week, which is a markets podcast. They were interviewing the Illinois state governor who has just implemented a range of tax changes, and one of which is a tax to social media platforms with a volume of users in Illinois as a direct direct consequence of the now proven harms that social media can cause children, young people and vulnerable adults. And so what they're doing is saying it costs us as a state government to deal with the issues that arise as a result of this. So you have to pay a tax for all of the users that you have on your platform in our state. Yeah. So I think by one way or another, this isn't going away.
Yeah. And positive steps are being taken, and I'm sure as this is meant to be implemented by early next spring, there'll be a lot of updates over the coming months as we see what happens.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see even the kind of reaction that people have on the podcast, though, because it's a hot topic, isn't it? And there's quite polarizing views on it.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, it definitely digs up all of those conversations about, what you have the right to do and not to do, and lots of sort of debate around society's role in guiding people's individual behaviour, and then where the law kind of comes into that. But I think it's important that as a society we keep revisiting this because, like I said, you know, that everyone thought the smoking ban was a bit of an opposition to human rights, but at the end of the day, I think everybody accepts that there are no health benefits from smoking.
No.
It only costs public health services a lot of money to deal with the consequences of. And sure, if you want to make an individual choice to smoke, go do that and do it only in your own home. Don't do it anywhere else where you're going to impact somebody else.
Well, I think, you know, when the product or the experience is addictive, it takes that kind of element of free will.
Absolutely, and a choice out of it. And we're heading down that road with many other things. Gambling is one of them. And again, if we start talking about the advertising industry associated with that, we're going to start to see a lot more control around gambling companies in general, but also how they market and advertise to people and what messages they send. I don't know about you guys, but I've already started seeing on streaming services more gambling aware style ads where they're actually showing protagonists. Protagonists in the ads making different choices, which is there's no way gambling companies would be doing that unless they were encouraged down that line.
Yeah,
that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah, and I agree.
There's regulation in every other area, pharmaceutical advertising, very strong regulations around that in the UK, less so in the US, but still there are guardrails around what you can and can't advertising. I think it's commonplace in a civilized society.
Sugar, like so many
that's it. High fat, sugar, salt contents regulations.
And these are very new.
Yeah.
So, they're following suit on the social side.
That's right.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I'm going to move us on to our third story. Consulting firm Accenture have agreed to acquire creator and social agency Whaler from Whaler Group, strengthening the creator and influencer marketing capabilities of its creative arm Accenture Song. The deal reflects the growing importance of the creator economy, with social platforms increasingly shaping brand discovery, consumer engagement and commerce. Whaler Group will also enter a three-year strategic partnership with Accenture Song focused on creator economy innovation. Ant, what do you think of this acquisition?
I guess, first of all, it is kind of further evidence of the allure of the whole creator economy, and in particular, the kind of consultancies and holding companies wanting a piece of that. They you know, I would suggest are not experts in that area and very much want a piece of it or fear being left behind. So... evidence of the allure, and of course, you know, a lot of the big advertising groups are, advertising brands such as Unilever have talked about, increasing their spend in the creator economy, so that they have to do something. So, acquiring one of the biggest agencies in that space, you know, I can see why they've done it. Will it be a success? Will it make them better? I can't think of many examples where it ever really works. I can't think of any agencies that got better once they got bought. But I can see why they've done it.
Yeah,
that's my kind of first reaction to it, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point there. Can't think of many agencies that have gotten better after an acquisition. Also, you know, I mean, it does seem, you know, culturally an interesting fit. You know, one of the big, global consultancy firms who already, you wouldn't say that, you know, an agency approach to client services is in their DNA. They've had to develop that over time, you know, and they did that by setting up various teams and making some interesting acquisitions, creating Accenture Song. And, you know, I always think actually on the eve of heading to Cannes, or, you know, not quite the eve, but Cannes will be on next week. Mm. Whenever I'm there and I'm wandering up the ad tech row where all the yachts are, there's an Accenture Song yacht there with nobody on it. And I'm always finding myself thinking, is it because you guys are being a bit more Accenture, or you're being a bit, anyway, so it'll be really interesting to see what activations they do this year, especially having
there's
made
some
their,
creators on the yacht.
That's it. But, you know, and in fairness, it has been sort of increasing its profile, I would say, year on year. But anyway, that doesn't seem like a natural fit. But you're quite right. Holdcos have made some very similar acquisitions over the last couple of years. So, and I think, you know, there's no doubt about the fact that a creator-led marketing approach is essential in today's modern marketing mix.
Yep.
And it's really interesting that CPGs are talking about spending more budget in that area. And I think it's leading towards a broadening of what I would consider to be a commerce media offering, that you need to have a whole range of touch points across various, you know, commerce related channels, and you know, creator led content and marketing makes perfect sense in that context. And you see, especially also, we're not quite on the eve, but not very far away from ATS Singapore in a couple of weeks' time. So we'll be out there in the APAC market. You see the amazing things that they've achieved by bringing together a sort of an influencer and creator led marketing led lens together with live commerce to create this commerce media environment that's actually really aggressively growing. And so, you know, any agency that really wants to do well for their clients has got to have that in their wheelhouse somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, back to the point we talked about a lot, you know, creators now are trusted voices in a world where, you know, it's really hard to know what content to trust or believe in. These creators are trusted voices. They have communities that follow them, and they're incredibly valuable. I think the thing that we're always talking about with our clients is, you know, what's the brand's role with these guys because they're very attractive, they're close to culture, you know, which every brand wants to be. But how does the brand play a distinctive role in there, rather than, you know, it just being an add-on, you know, that and in the worst case that can be, you know, just such a temporary engagement. So, you know, finding really authentic partnerships, ideally that have longevity, so that they become distinctive for the brand, I think is really important. But you're right with the, you know, the increase in kind of social commerce and these creators being able to sell directly through social platforms. I think that's another huge opportunity, not just for engagement, but for sales, for retailing.
Exactly, and I sort of think that is a it's a broadening out of that retail piece for sure. And also, what's interesting, sort of leaning into something you just mentioned there, Ant, the sort of the trust and reliability element that's now associated with influencer marketing is really interesting, because when it sort of first emerged, it was almost the opposite. It was like, well, how can I, you know, I'm not going to, you know, really believe some person, even if they're mildly famous, talking about products. I'm just going to imagine that they've been paid to say those things. Whereas now, because our lives have become so digitized, and because we're all so concerned about fake content and fake, you know, fake creative, as well, the idea that actually it could be somebody that you know exists in real life, even if you don't know them personally in real life, that actually has a community that they engage with on a social media platform, that is actually now more of a trusted voice.
That's right.
Than, you know, than many other things that appear on platforms and are digitally created. So I think that all speaks to our desire for that authentic connection. And it's really interesting that we're now applying that lens to a digital environment, and the creator economy, I think, is doing really well out
And actually, according to the IAB, ad spend in the US creator economy is among the fastest growing sectors in all of media, which is expected to reach $43.9 billion in 2026. So I guess you've kind of touched on some of these areas, but what kind of innovation do you expect to come out of the creator economy in the next couple of years?
Good question. So back to one of our earlier conversations, I think creators not just being content creators, but probably acting more like, you know, businesses and brands. So having, having a wider footprint and touch points where they, you know, they own the IP, they create products and services that they sell through multiple platforms, acting more like brands and publishers, I think, rather than just individual content creators. I think also the point we said around social commerce and the rise of, you know, selling, not just entertaining, will be a big shift.
Being authentic.
And I think that's a really good point, that actually you're talking about a channel where maybe people come to it for entertainment first and foremost, but turning that into more of an authentic selling channel. So not just I'm entertaining you, plus I've got this, a bit like you described earlier on, this kind of slightly meaningless to me product hanging around in the background, rather actually turning it into more of which I think you see a lot of on social media platforms. It's somebody that you know, it might be a celebrity or a famous person, but they are selling a product and they're actually going into detail about that product. They become a product expert. So they're not just advocating that the product is good. They're actually showing you how they use it. They're showing the results that they get from it, those sorts of things. And I can remember in the early days of discussing social commerce boom in APAC, looking at some videos that were being filmed. So it was a video taken from somebody who was filming in a department store in China, all of the like influencers that were creating individual videos on their accounts around the store. And, you know, some of them were really practical. If you're talking about makeup, then someone's actually showing you the product and then showing you how they apply it. And so it's a kind of a cross between the sales expert and a trusted voice that's got another dimension to them, whether it's, you know, that they're known for being a personality or an entertainer.
Yeah. And you, yeah, you kind of aspire to their lifestyle, but trust their advice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it makes them more relatable. I think, again, it is bringing in that sort of, weirdly, that in-person, in-real-life connection, but in a digital environment on a larger scale. So, you know, in terms of where we might see it go, I'm just expecting that to get actually more and more creative as time goes on, and it could start to get really interesting. Once again, I think it comes back down to the quality of, you know, the sort of the output, the creative output, and what is actually resonating with people that drives retail results, that drives commercial results. Yeah.
It's a really interesting space, and it is booming.
It is. Yeah.
Excellent. I think we'll end it there. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
it's
you.
Been great
no,
to
it's
have
been
you.
Really interesting. Thank you.
And we're also going to see and hear more from the 99ers at ATS London. We've got your co-founder.
Yes, that's joining right. Sorry, as well. Joining. So, yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, we look
Exciting
forward to
time.
It. And Rachel, thank you as always.
My pleasure. Always good great. To be on the MedTech podcast.
Great. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.